Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on trends in state licensing. Under new leadership, there's been some policy shifts at the federal level within the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, and more states have taken it upon themselves to ramp up their consumer protection efforts. One of the ways in which they are increasing their regulatory oversight is by enacting or toughening licensing requirements for collection agencies, debt buyers, and other ARM industry participants. We're fortunate to have a couple of licensing experts with us here today who will share their insights into what they see going on at the state level and provide guidance to help companies navigate these increasingly troublesome waters. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Cornerstone Support. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Christy Young-Barger is the Director of Risk Management Licensing with Cornerstone Support. Prior to working at Cornerstone, she was a paralegal who specialized in estate, civil, corporate, and real estate law. In 2005, she started at Cornerstone Support as a renewal specialist. This position allowed her to work with both clients and regulators directly with each state to ensure the client's business licensing was done correctly and on time. In her current role as the Director of Risk Management Licensing, she speaks with the collection industry's leaders to navigate clients through new licensing based on agency activity, statutory compliance notifications regarding corporate changes, and the overall client expansion and development. John Sacknat is the practice leader of Ballard Spahr's Mortgage Banking Group and a member of the firm's Marketplace Lending Task Force. John also leads Ballard Spahr's licensing practice. He devotes his practice to counseling financial services institutions on compliance and licensing matters under state and federal law, preparing them for examinations and audits by state and federal regulators, including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and defending them in enforcement actions. John assists clients with developing compliance programs and implementing and operationalizing new regulations. John is a frequent presenter at industry conferences and is a member of the Advisory Council to the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators, or ARMR, the SRR Industry Advisory Council, and a fellow of the American College of Consumer Financial Services Lawyers. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. A recording of this event will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. And with that, let's launch into our discussion. Christy will give you the honor of the first question. Let's talk about how an agency should go about setting or obtaining a license in a given state.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining. This is not an easy question to answer. When you're determining your license, you have to talk to experts, talk to attorneys, and make solid, informed decisions. As your business model changes, we see a lot of agencies will start out as commercial, collecting only commercial, and then they'll start consumer. Each change such as that, you need to look to make sure that you're properly licensed. Different activity requires different licenses. It's funny, I get asked a lot, I want one license that covers the whole United States. Well, if it was that easy, we probably wouldn't all be here today. So just know that each state is a little different. Each activity that you do, purchasing debt, collections, everything requires separate licensing. One other thing that you have to think about whenever you are scoping out your licensing project is how your company is formed, where it's located, if it's outside the U.S. Some states will not license foreign locations. So those are the kind of things that you want to talk with an expert or an attorney about to make sure that you are properly covered before your collection activity begins or your purchasing activity begins.
Yeah, Christy, that I agree with you 100%. You know, it's absolutely critical that you engage the right people to help you understand the regulatory landscape. There is a lot of nuance to this. Lots of people can read statutes and regulations. Unfortunately, what is on the face of a statute or regulation isn't always the way that a particular state regulatory agency will interpret their particular provisions. So it's important to understand the nuance and engage with folks who have relationships and have experience with advising institutions about these various licensing requirements.
Before moving on, let me ask either one of you, can you share maybe an example of the type of nuance that can maybe sort of confuse or otherwise trip up a company in the arm industry when it comes to dealing with a particular state or a particular type of license?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and John may have one as well. Like I mentioned, there's different licenses if you do commercial collections versus consumer. Some of the states will exempt your company from that licensing. As far as debt buying, passive and active debt buying triggers different licenses. You would move from a passive to an active debt buyer, for example, if you collect on the debt that you purchase or if you file lawsuits in some states. So each type of debt might trigger a different license for you.
Yeah, I'll give an example. Under Tennessee's collection service law, a license is required in order to collect claims, and I forget the other word, I'm sorry, but they exclude collecting on notes or guarantees. So interestingly, that if you are collecting on loans, even if it's delinquent at the time you begin collecting, you would not need a Tennessee collection service license, but if you are collecting on other types of debt, you do. Again, in the statute, but it's sort of counterintuitive, and very unique. And there are, Christy gave some good examples, and there are unfortunately, you know, other examples throughout the country.
Excellent, thanks, John. Let me circle back to you for the next question. Does the type of debt that is collected impact the kind of license that may be required?
Absolutely, yeah. Good segue from our last comments. Christy pointed out a couple of examples, but there are differences between consumer and commercial. There's differences between passive and active collections. Some states merely having the right to collect requires you to have a license, even if you engage a licensed third party. And then obviously, definitely different types of debt. Beyond collection agency licenses, if you are collecting or servicing other types of debt, whether those are student loans or mortgages or even various types of consumer debt that has been originated under a particular statute, you may need that very same license in order to service or collect on that debt. Other nuances sort of beyond the type of debt, but location of the debtor, location of the creditor, whether you're engaged in your activity within a state or only using interstate communication means, delinquency, non-delinquency, and a lot of these are common things and themes, and we'll talk about them a lot. But those absolutely all can impact the extent to which a particular type of license is required.
Absolutely, John. We see that every day. One thing I've seen recently, a lot of questions coming in, is about auto. So if you collect on auto deficiencies, that can trigger some additional licensing. So again, it's every different type is going to put you in a different licensing box.
Is there a reason why you think you're seeing questions about auto now, maybe more so than you've seen in the past?
No, I we were actually talking about that the other day. Things kind of seem to come in waves, and auto just seems to be the hot one right now. I know there's a lot of debt in the auto, so I don't know if that's what's triggering it or if it's just there's a lot of it out there right now, and the debt buyers are looking at those portfolios.
It's a great question, and I think Christy's right. It's sometimes we scratch our heads sometimes why we seem to get the same questions from multiple clients or potential clients about the same issue in a very short time window, and I think oftentimes that's driven by debt purchasers in the back end or somebody writes an article about the CFPB wanting to focus more on, indirect auto lending and fair lending issues and making sure that people are appropriately licensed who are participating in the transactions.
Got it. Christy, when it comes to obtaining or maintaining a state license, you know, what do you see as sort of the most common areas that collection agencies tend to overlook?
They overlook the fact that each state is different. They're going to ask for different requirements with those applications. One thing we have a lot of people seem to struggle with is trust accounts. Some states require that you have a trust account that the money collected in that state runs through. Some states require that they have a branch of that bank in their state in order for you to use that. So trust accounts seem to be something I've seen a lot of people struggle with lately. Financials, that seems to be another roadblock and tripping stone for many people. Will the state take internal financials? It says reviewed, but can I send internal instead? Will they take my parent company financials? Here's a good one that we have a lot come back. We'll say you have negative net worth, and they'll say, no, we don't. Well, if you take your goodwill out, which some of the states do, you're negative. So submitting that application is gonna get you a denial or a pushback with a deficiency. So those are some of the ones that we really see on the initial side. Once we get to the renewals, one thing that we see a lot of is the supplemental filings. Some states have multiple filings in order to keep a license current. It's not just that simple one time a year license renewal. There's license annual reports, there's CPA assessment fees. And if you don't renew those, your license is affected. The collection manager in Nevada, in Michigan, that's a separate filing. And if you don't renew your manager, they're going to have to go test again, and they're not going to like that. So all of those different filings have to be done each year in order to keep those licenses current. I think the last thing that I see a lot of is cities are overlooked. Somebody will say, you know, I need an Illinois license. Okay, that's great. You need Illinois, and the city of Chicago has their own license as well. New York is another state that has cities that the actual state doesn't license collection agencies, but three cities do, Yonkers, New York City, and Buffalo. So those are the things that people really seem to overlook at times.
Yeah, Christy, I agree. On the back end, in particular, I think lots of companies don't appreciate the capital and resource outlay it takes to maintain the various licenses. You talked about all the filings, making sure you're hitting renewals, et cetera. On the front end, a number of our clients struggle with policies and procedures. Some states want them specific and unique to their particular collection practices. State compliant forms, correspondent, et cetera, they want samples, and they don't want just generic samples. They want a sample that is has a specific language or requirements of the particular state. Also on maintenance, and we'll talk about this a little bit more when we discuss the NMLS, and that's the system that more and more state regulators are migrating their administration of licenses to. There are obligations when you have a license that's managed via the NMLS to constantly keep your record updated. So you're talking about updating when there's ownership changes, adding trade names or DBAs, and then also reporting about significant events. You've been sued. You have a regulatory enforcement action brought against you, even if it's not something that's public. Those are burdens that, again, folks aren't necessarily looking at closely on the front end, and sometimes are surprised on the back end. And these are particularly problematic when you are coming from another industry. So you are a mortgage servicer or a student loan servicer or a servicer of consumer debt from inception, right? It's current. But there are states where that require a collection agency license if debt becomes delinquent. And those companies in particular struggle with, well, I don't have collection procedures. I'm a servicer. And unfortunately, that doesn't work with a regulator to say, well, I don't really do that. Well, if you're pursuing a license, you've got to satisfy the regulator's requirements.
Absolutely. We do see that a lot as well. One other thing that this could people kind of struggle with, the license is needed where you're collecting, not necessarily where you are collecting as the sitting as the collection agency. So if you're sitting in Georgia, you need a license to call into Tennessee. Some people have a really hard time understanding the difference of it's not where you are located, it's where you're calling into and doing your collection activity. They also kind of struggle with, we have multiple locations from which we are collecting. Then we need to talk about branch licensing, because one license doesn't cover every location that you have in most of the states. They each have their separate licensing requirements that those companies need to look at. And I think on purpose, some people try to look over that because it's more work and more money. But that's something we've seen states call people out on, where their collectors are located and not having a licensed branch.
You know, we've only been talking about this for like a few minutes and already my head is spinning. This is a question I'm sure I'm going to ask probably, you know, a dozen times between now and the end of the webinar, but how do you, as a collection agency, how do you kind of make sure you're staying on top of all of this stuff? I mean, it seems like it's incredibly overwhelming, and I know that maybe most collection agencies only have to deal with a couple of states. They're not collecting on a national level, but there are clients that, you know, want collection agencies that are nationally licensed, sort of in air quotes. So as an agency, you know, or as, you know, people who counsel collection agencies, what advice do you give them to kind of make sure that they're staying on top of all of this?
On Cornerstone side, you look at it more than once. It's not a one-time deal where you get licensed and you're good forever. Being in the industry, one thing we do is we send out blasts. When something changes with a state, we will send out blasts to our clients and others in the industry to tell them that Washington now needs a consumer loan license for student loan collection. And then that triggers calls to dig in deeper to see if that license is needed. It almost always turns into they need more than one license added to their scope. So it's very important to keep looking at the licensing, and when you hear things, ask questions, talk to those experts again, review your licensing often.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot in the historically in sort of the CFPB context, but you know, the buzzword of a compliance management system, it's critical that you have one, and one of the pillars of that is constantly monitoring changes in state law, and there's a number of ways you can do that. You can do it yourself, you can staff up, hire compliance staff. That's expensive and costly. You can also outsource that monitoring, license maintenance renewal. Cornerstone, of course, does that. But that also has, you know, cost associated with it. You can attend webinars like this one, right? There's lots of webinars in the industry, some paid, many of which are free, that provide great insight and information about what's going on in the industry. At the end of the day, there's no magic pill, as it were, to satisfy all of that. It's some combination of having a robust policies and procedures for tracking and monitoring, leveraging as much as you can the resources that are available. Again, many of which are free. There are firms like ours that do hundreds and hundreds of webinars throughout the course of the year. Again, these webinars like this, incredibly informative and helpful to help you stay on top of an ever-changing environment. We've talked a little bit about, you know, nuances of states, and it's impossible for any one company, I think, to manage that on their own.
Definitely would agree with that. At this point, I just wanted to ask Krisky, do you want to take a minute and talk a little bit about Cornerstone as a sponsor, or do you want to prefer to keep moving on with the discussion?
Yeah, I can go ahead and do that and get that out of the way. Thanks, Mike. Cornerstone has been in business for over 20 years. We've become the premier licensing service for collection agencies, debt buyers, and attorneys. Cornerstone's expert compliance service includes licensing, bonding, and insurance. We are a one-stop shop. On the licensing side, we facilitate the entire licensing process from the preparation of the applications to an approved license certificate. As part of our service, we will generate and complete all necessary applications, supplements, and questionnaires. In addition, we will set up registered agents, resident managers, and remote offices as required. Our dedicated team is committed to meeting our clients' specific needs with quality service and expertise. Bonds are a critical part of the licensing process. We are proud to be a trusted bonding service for hundreds of collection agencies around the globe. Unlike a general surety bond, we specialize in collection agency bonds. We work with a wide variety of surety companies that have great solutions for all types of companies, small and large, old and new. We also write mortgage servicer and lender bonds, court bonds, notary bonds, contract and performance bonds, and many more. You can trust Cornerstone Support to provide world-class customer service and competitive rates for all of your surety bond needs. Lastly, Integrity First Insurance is our sister company that specializes in insurance cover for the RM industry. We offer exclusive error and omission programs designated to defend consumer lawsuits. We shop the market to compare options and make certain that you have the best value each year in terms of coverage, price, and deductible. No other insurance agent can provide the level of comprehensive service and expertise with your E&O coverage as we can. This is a critical line of defense against consumer lawsuits. We also offer other coverage lines for your business, including cyber liability and cover data breaches. Cornerstone Support provides a level of comprehensive service and expertise that is unparalleled in the industry. If we could ever be of assistance, please reach out to us.
Awesome. Thanks, Christy, and thanks again to Cornerstone for sponsoring today's webinar. Let me come back to you, Christy, with the next question. We've talked a little bit about sort of dealing with, you know, contacting borrowers in different states. When you're making phone calls, how can you tell if you're collecting from someone who lives in a state where you're required to have a license?
That is a hard question. You really can't. People don't set roots anymore. They move around. I spoke to someone just last week who had a 678 area code phone number, which is my area. So I answer the phone on a personal call or probably my personal phone. I answer that call and he's sitting in California. So he is not in Georgia. So people move around. Technology, it's very important that your company gets the right technology in place that will help with routing calls and determining where they're coming from. But again, we're all human. Those calls will make it through the technology.
Yeah, I mean, and someone actually has posed a question about this, and it's really difficult. You're going to try to leverage technology as much as you can. I think on the front end, a couple of things to do. Right, it's critical that you are getting the complete down. So that actually helps you determine what license you need and whether or not you can do it in the first place, right? So where was the debt incurred? Where is the creditor? Where is the borrower? What's the last known address of the borrower? Leveraging that. If you have policies and procedures in place that on the front end help you determine what laws a particular borrower is entitled to protect the protections of, in the event that somebody moves and doesn't tell you, even if you have procedures or policies that periodically ask for updated information, you will potentially get some leniency from a state regulator, but it's not going to be enough to say, oh, well, I didn't know, if you've got nothing in your policies and procedures that relate to vetting on the front end that this is an account that you can collect and service on, and having some sort of policies and procedures about keeping that information current to ensure that you can continue to collect on it. But, that's really problematic for, you know, regional collectors, right? If you're not licensed all across the country, that's a difficult thing to grapple with.
Is that an endorsement then maybe of an approach where an agency is licensed in every state that, you know, that requires it, just because you never know if you're, you know, if you're contacting somebody in that state?
You know, with Christy and I have talked about this a little bit. Not necessarily. There are a variety of reasons why for some companies that makes sense, but for others, the volume just wouldn't support it. If you do go out and get licensed in all 50 states, you can use that as a competitive advantage, right? You can tell creditors, look, we're licensed everywhere. It doesn't matter where anybody moves. They move without telling you, we can collect because we're appropriately licensed. Something that regionals might want to consider is entering into strategic relationships with other companies that may have licenses where they don't, and vice versa, so that you can present a solution to potential clients. Look, I'm licensed regionally. My expertise is the Southwest, but I have relationships with others, and it's the same pricing. Again, I'm getting into stuff that you all on the phone know much better than I about how to generate the business. But that's another option, right? And so then if you do determine that a particular account, a borrower has a debtor has moved to a state where you're not licensed, you potentially have the ability to continue to service that account by leveraging some sort of strategic relationship.
Got it. Thanks. Moving on. So I talked a little bit about it in my introduction to setting the table that, you know, certain federal regulators appear to be reducing at least their public enforcement and supervisory activities. Various states are stepping up and filling the void. We've talked, there have been consumer protection units formed in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, just to cite a couple. Are you seeing any of this on a more national level, Christy?
Yeah, it's across the board. The state regulators are watching complaints filed, and they're talking to each other. People laugh when I say regulators talk, but they actually do. They share information. They share disciplinary actions. And so increasing the enforcement is definitely spreading across state lines. As far as the licensing goes, there are some states that have increased their financial requirements. Connecticut, for a while, changed their minimum net worth up to $50,000. It used to be lower than that. So they changed the actual filing requirements as well. If you find yourself on the radar in one state, you can guarantee that you're going to go into other state radars. And that's something that we really stress to our clients, of making sure their licensing is in place so that doesn't happen to them.
Yeah, Christy, great points. I think maybe just a word of caution, right? We've heard a lot, and much has been written about in the press about the change, arguably an attitude from Director Cordray now to Director Mulvaney. And I think what's important, and even just this past weekend at the Mortgage Bankers Association annual convention, Mulvaney essentially declared, regulation by enforcement is over. In other words, just because they don't like something doesn't mean that they're going to hammer companies for it. But I think it's important to keep in mind that even at the federal level, right, if something is illegal, there still are going to be repercussions. But the sort of stepping back a little bit from maybe what's in the gray area does create additional opportunities for attorneys general and the state regulators. They didn't like and don't like that as the CFPB was being stood up, that much of the blame for the financial crisis went to state regulators, that, the folks who were standing up the CFPB were saying were asleep at the switch, that they weren't properly protecting consumers. So yes, there will always be AGs and state regulators that are going to step up enforcement. I think we're also entering a rising interest rate environment. And with rising interest rates, you have potential payment amounts changing, which means more delinquencies and defaults, which means more consumer complaints, which means even more opportunity for state regulators to come after you. So it is important to continue to be vigilant and be focused on compliance. And it starts with licensing. There was the former North Carolina regulator who told me many years ago that the critical piece for them was whether a company was appropriately licensed, because if they couldn't even get licensing correct, they had real concerns about whether they were otherwise able to comply with the other substantive requirements of their particular law.
An interesting point. Do you recommend outreach on behalf of the agencies to their state regulators, to their state ADs? Opening lines of dialogue, being a resource to answer questions. Does that kind of relationship help at all?
I'll take that one first, Christy. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead. No, please go ahead.
Yeah, it absolutely can have value. We advocate this for our clients in various spaces. If you were launching, a new business or changing your business, or you're expanding and want to be in all of the states, by and large, regulators are happy to meet with industry to learn more about them. My own view is that establishing that relationship and trying to demonstrate to a regulator that you're committed and care about compliance can be critical if an issue comes up. They've met you. They know about you. Hey, you were just in here and I got this weird complaint, or I'm hearing things. Can you sort of fill me in on what's going on? You've started to build that relationship. I think as a general rule, that absolutely has value. You've got to do it in the right way. You've got to make sure you approach the right people at the right time. But those are things that I absolutely think, Mike, are a great idea. And for the right company in the right instances can really add value.
Well, I'm not sure I can follow that. That was great, John. Thank you.
All I was going to say is that, the best defense is a good offense, I guess, sometimes. John, back to you. I've heard from a number of agency executives who have expressed either their intention or their outright plan to withdraw from certain states if they're not conducting enough business. And this is something we started talking about a little bit in terms of the cost-benefit analysis. Because the licensing requirements are becoming too burdensome, is this something you're seeing as well? How important is it today for an agency to say they're collecting in all 50 states?
Yeah, great question. We hear about it a fair amount from clients who say, I just don't want to deal with Massachusetts and it's difficult and I've waited a year and they keep reviewing and re-reviewing our business plan and I don't even know I want to be in the state at all. And so maybe anecdotally, I could say that there's some of that. But I think that there is real value or perceived value in being able to say you're licensed, all across the country. I know that there are creditors, so potential clients, who want someone who can service them all across the country. Again, that presents opportunities for those that can, strap it on and go through the burden of getting and maintaining licenses, even if volume in particular states don't warrant it. It's also, as I said earlier, you've got to get creative if you want to compete for business. And so to create strategic relationships or partnerships with other regionals or other companies they can fill your gaps and you can fill theirs. Certainly something to give consideration to. I've been a believer in, if you're going to go ahead and get licensed everywhere, then absolutely use it as a competitive advantage, as a differentiator. And those are the realities, right? So if you're not licensed everywhere, you then have to figure out how you can also differentiate yourself and make compelling arguments and reasons to potential clients as to why, notwithstanding that you don't have a license in a particular jurisdiction, that you're able to handle the accounts.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Some of the credit grantors do not like the out-of-state exemptions, for example, in Michigan and Alaska. They want to see those agencies actually having a certificate in hand. I've heard people say they were going to withdraw licenses. My advice is don't go backwards. You have that in place. It's usually the states that are expensive and have a lot of collector registrations, Minnesota and Idaho, where you have to individually license your collectors. I've heard people say, I'm coming out of that state because it's just too much money. There's ways to route calls and only register a few collectors. So we advise them they should look at that and really have strong conversations to make good decisions before they just go withdraw something that they have in place. And one last thing, we have been engaged by large banks to perform audits on people in the agencies in the industry. And if they don't see those licenses everywhere, I have seen them pull business. One lady hung up the phone with me and immediately called and fired a company because they weren't licensed where they said they were. And it's just too big of a risk for them. So that they want to see those licenses.
Show me your license and registration, I guess. Moving on, Christy, let's start looking ahead at the horizon here a little bit. Are there, of the states that don't have licensing requirements currently, do you see any, when you look in your crystal ball, that may choose to do so in the future?
Absolutely. We track and monitor hundreds of bills and legislative changes that will directly affect our industry. There's one we've been watching for, 3 years probably, New York State. You know, they have the individual city licenses, but New York State is looking to enact their own license. The different types of student loan has become very popular now. There's additional licensing on those. I was in a conference last week where the regulator said that 10 to 12 more states are looking to enact student loan servicer licensing in the very near future. I definitely see it's continuing to change for our industry.
Yeah, I mean, it is surprising to people that, you know, New York State doesn't have a collection agency license. California, of all places, right, doesn't have a collection agency license. And I think most people would put those at the top of the list of really active regulators, and states that are, you would think, would be likely to enact something. As a practical matter, though, right, I mean, all of that, or virtually in every state, that would require some sort of legislative action. And so someone's got to get behind a bill and sponsor it, and then even if somebody decided today that they wanted to license in New York, absent some crazy rule and accelerated effective date, you're looking at, 12 months, 18 months before that license requirement would even come online. Circumstances can dictate that, right? If the deputy commissioner in a particular state gets calls from a company and deems those calls to be abusive or the like, that's the kind of thing that can trigger a discussion with the commissioner, who then goes to the legislature and says, this is ridiculous, and we have all these, we don't have a requirement for a license in our state, and we need to protect our consumers. But yes, we will see them. And I think, as Christy said, the expansion of collections, right, of servicing into other asset classes, student loan servicer in particular, more will absolutely be coming.
What's the saying? Bad acts make bad laws. I guess maybe that's a ringing true a little bit here. John, let's look a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about Oregon, Massachusetts, two states that had laws that were either changed or went into effect this year. Looking at those, as well as are there any other states on your radar for sort of ones that, are the most concerning?
Yeah, I mean, Massachusetts should always be on someone's radar. It's a very active and fairly sophisticated regulatory agency. They really, really scrutinize license applications and business plans. So Massachusetts is always somebody to worry about. New York is always somebody to worry about. Most of the other states, high population states, have some sort of collection agency license or registration. I can't think of any other ones that jump to mind immediately, other than to remind everybody that just because a state does not have a licensing requirement does not mean that it does not have either a mini FDCPA or their own collection agency substantive requirements statute that applies whether, even without regard to whether you need to be licensed or not.
I totally agree with John. Thank you for that. Massachusetts is one. We speak that word often around here. I've also seen that the states that have the licensing board still in place, which is, it's just a few, they seem to really look at how the consumers are being treated and seem to change their approach to licensing quite often after they have those board meetings.
And Christy, remind us of those. There's Wyoming has a collection board, and they're transitioning to the NMLS, and we'll talk about this a little bit, and that'll be an interesting evolution there.
Nebraska has a board left, and Arkansas. Wyoming is very active with their board. They really look at the applications. They look at consumer complaints. They take pride in those licensing requirements there. So while that's a good thing, we as an agency, or we in the industry, have to make sure we're properly licensed.
John, you teed up the NNLS, so let's move to that. Talking about that and maybe some other trends with particular states that are updating or amending their licensing procedures?
Sure. So let me touch on a couple of things before we jump to the NMLS. Debt buyer, right? We mentioned Oregon, and we've seen some case law, actually some of it favorable at Northeast. But debt buyer, both active and passive, we're continuing to see states amend their statutes to expressly cover that. And, you know, the worst is the passive debt buyer. Oh, I bought debt, even if it wasn't delinquent, someone else is going to service it for me, but that makes me a collection agency. Doesn't make a lot of sense and clearly is beyond the initial intent, I would argue, of collection agency and debt collection laws. But we've seen regulatory creep in all the other asset classes, mortgage in particular, and the other asset classes, I think, are following along. The other trend we're seeing, and it's been a little bit slower in the collection agency side than it has been in some of the other license types or asset classes, but that's transitioning to the NMLS. And just very quickly, for those that don't know, the NMLS actually used to be called Nationwide Mortgage Licensing System. It was created for the state regulators to administer their mortgage-related licenses. They changed the name to the Nationwide Multi-State Licensing System because a number of states found that the system worked well for them. They're created, in theory, greater efficiencies. So a number of states have transitioned virtually all of their various licenses to the NMLS. We're seeing more and more states doing that in the collection agency space. And again, in theory, it's supposed to drive uniformity, but there are a lot of differences between getting licensed in NMLS versus non-NMLS states, and Christy's going to chime in here as well because Cornerstone does a lot of work in this area as well. Couple of the highlights, right? If it's a non-NMLS state, right, we have variation as to what the license application itself looks like, what the process is, what information is required. Is there background checking? Is there not? Is there a bond? Where do you send the forms? Is it electronic? Do you have to mail it in? The NMLS is designed for uniformity. If you are on the NMLS, you have what is supposed to be a complete and accurate account of all your core information, and you have obligations, we'll talk about this in a little bit, to keep it complete, accurate, up to date. And we've got on the slide here a bunch of bullets, and this is really more of a takeaway. But the NMLS has, excuse me, uniformity in that if a state is administering their license through the NMLS, even if their statute or their paper application historically didn't ask for information, all of the information on here, with the exception of surety bonds, right, that they'd have to have a statutory change to go from no bond to bond. But all of this kind of stuff has to be uploaded onto the NMLS because it is part of your core record. The criminal background checks is a really big one, right? There's this concept of control persons, which is your officers and directors and ultimate natural person owners of 10% or more. And they have to do their own, you'll see it on the slide here, the MU2 form, which has biographical information. It also has detailed questions about past litigation, criminal convictions, as well as whether you've been involved either individually or as an officer or director of a company that has had regulatory enforcement actions. Mike, maybe we can just go to the next slide. Thank you. Again, you know, one of the problems with the NMLS is that the regulators will tell you over and over and over again, the NMLS is not a regulator. It doesn't make the law. There's a policy guidebook that's designed to give information about what type of disclosures you make, what words mean, how they're defined. But you will find that notwithstanding that, state regulators are sort of all over the map in terms of how they interpret things. They will require things or try to direct you to, for example, put 100% of your indirect ownership on the NMLS, which is actually not required, and the NMLS wasn't designed for that. Maybe Mike, just flip to the next one. again, the MU1 form, right, you're forced to list all of your executive officers and directors if you're a corporation, if you're an LLC and you have a board of managers, you list them. You have to list direct ownership, indirect ownership. That's a big change from a lot of states who license collection agencies in paper now. Typically, it's give me your direct ownership or it's silent as to indirect ownership. There are affirmative obligations on the NMLS to do that. You have to create a org chart and listing all of your affiliates if you have any. And this is a really big one, and this is one where there could be lots of foot faults. There are ongoing obligations to update your NMLS record in the event of significant changes, right? So ownership changes. A lot of states now, by statute, wouldn't require, for example, prior notice or prior approval for an ownership change, but they move to the NMLS and then want an advance notice of 30 days or 60 days. And even though their statute doesn't provide and require prior approval, there have been instances where the state regulators have said, yes, but now you're on the NMLS, and so I need to approve this. Let me stop there and let Christy jump in here and touch on anything that I failed to highlight.
No, John, that was wonderful. You covered everything great. Thank you so much. One thing that we see is the definition of a control person. That might be different from Massachusetts to Maryland, but since they're on the NMLS, if Massachusetts identifies someone as a control person, you're then updating your records in Maryland. So when those people change, you still have to make notifications. And like John mentioned, some states don't go up to indirect ownership, but now that they're on the NMLS, they do. And so it's very important to update when these changes happen and know that one filing affects others. We have seen a company submit a new application for a state, and within 3 days, they have 5 deficiencies from other states where there was nothing due, but they saw a change in the licensing information, and so they wanted to know more.
Real quick, I wanted to touch on enforcement actions. What's very interesting is that the NMLS has very specific and very broad, I would argue, rules about what types of enforcement actions or settlements have to be disclosed, even if they're not publicly available. And one of the downsides to being on the NMLS is that once you have an NMLS account and you have any licenses that are issued by any states that use the NMLS, there's a place called NMLS Consumer Access, and you can type in the name of a company and it will tell you what licenses they hold and their locations and contact information. The very bottom of the screen, there's a drop down that says enforcement actions. That is a place where a consumer can go to one place to see any enforcement actions that you have entered into. And unfortunately, under the rules of the NMLS, you could enter into an agreement, a settlement agreement, for example, with a state regulator, and you can neither admit nor deny. For purposes of the NMLS, that's still an enforcement action that where you were deemed to have been found in violation of the law, even though on its express terms, it says you neither admit nor deny. So again, as you transition into the NMLS, there's lots of opportunities for foot faults, and it's even more important to, you know, have the appropriate procedures in place so that you're monitoring changes and being timely about your updating.
John, do you see that when disciplinary actions or court actions are leveled against a company, do you see that the notification to the states is timely made? You know, there's certain states that want that very quickly. Other states will let you update at renewal time. Do you see agencies keeping up with that very well?
It's a great question. What's interesting is states will hammer you if you fail to timely update. But I've seen very few instances where there have been additional repercussions for providing the update. So everyone, you know, worries, well, Tennessee was overly broad, it entered into something, and now every other state is going to come look at me. Does that trigger, in some instances, a regulator to put on their radar or maybe look more closely? Sure. I've actually seen it more the reverse, where you get hammered for not telling the state, more so than you tell the state and you give your explanation and you put your own, you know, spin on it. And that's a critical thing, right? Telling the regulator what happened and why you've already addressed it and why They really shouldn't be worried. Has its significant advantages over, you know, not telling them, and then, well, what are you trying to hide from me? But yeah, great question, Kristen.
Thank you, John.
Christy, do you want to just talk? I'm sure.
Yeah, go ahead, John. Set it up.
I was going to say, Christy, do you want to talk about the renewal? NMLS can be helpful.
Yeah, it can. They've changed. A lot of the states used to be a 1-year license. So if you obtain that license, you know, March 1st, it's going to renew March 1st of the next year. Since these states are going on to the NMLS, we have the 12/31 renewal date. So it's a little easier to keep up when they are due. You know what's coming. You can budget for it. That's another thing that a lot of agencies struggle with. You know, the filing fees and the renewal fees, they're not cheap. So budgeting and knowing when they're due, that's a great thing about the NMLS. One thing that I also know about the NMLS, you have to log in every so often or your password will expire. And while that doesn't seem like a big deal, on 12/30, when you're trying to renew a license and you can't get somebody on the phone at the NMLS to reset your password, it's not a good day.
Yeah, and just one final thing about the NMLS. I talked about the obligation to keep things complete and accurate. If you are a control person, and speaking to Christy's point about your password, you periodically, when various things or changes happen, have to log in and attest. And particularly if you're an account administrator, you have to attest to the completeness and accuracy of all of the information that is on file. That's very difficult to do, and you've got to have policies and procedures in place to make sure that the right people are getting notices about any changes. For example, a control person, there are questions about, you know, have you ever declared bankruptcy? Have you ever been charged or convicted of a felony? You would think that you would know that if that happened, but we have had instances where, you know, control persons for our clients, that has happened in the middle of a licensing process and nobody knows about it until the regulator says, oh, I just saw this article in the paper and your CFO was, you know, just convicted of a felony. But there are repercussions for, in theory, at least, making false certifications. So that's another part about the NMLS that can be a little bit scary is, you are certifying and attesting to the completeness and accuracy of the information that's on the system.
And John, I see a lot of the executives of the companies really pushing back on, why do I have to go attest this? Well, it's your personal information. You are saying with these applications that this is true and accurate. You can't have your receptionist or your secretary attest for you because they ask very specific questions that only you're going to know, like which one of the following 10 numbers has never been your phone number. The questions are sometimes hard for the people that they relate to. So that's kind of a little hiccup there with NMLS as well.
Excellent. Well, we're almost out of time. We do have a few questions. So before we get to the last question for Christy and John that I have here queued up, let's see if we can tackle some of these questions that have been entered in by the people who are listening in. First, can you discuss any issues with medical collections by Interstate Communications?
I'll take that one first, Christy, and then, you know, there has been a lot of focus of late on medical collections. I think I know that we have clients that are struggling with this. There's been a renewed focus on regulators, and there are certainly some out there that are involved in medical collections who are not being mindful of some of the unique provisions and laws that relate to collection of medical debt. But it presents a lot of the same issues that we talked about before. I'm on vacation in Florida, and I get bit by a shark, and I go to the local hospital, and you know my insurance doesn't cover all of it, and I go back to West Virginia. What are the rules about, you know, collection? Is it Florida law? Is it West Virginia law? What if I'm not licensed in West Virginia? What if I didn't know that they were there? And then you've got, you know, the overlay of specific rules and additional restrictions and protections that you have to provide when you're collecting medical debt.
Absolutely. And I think that happens a lot. People are on vacation or out of town and end up in a hospital or in a urgent care. And then that debt follows them back to their home state. It's very important to know that if you are collecting into another state, you've got to make sure that license is in place. So you want to, that conservative license approach really covers you in this area.
Excellent. Moving on. Is there a list of which states that have the specific time requirement to disclose a new enforcement action versus the states that are allow you to disclose it at the next renewal?
I've seen something like that here at Cornerstone. I can see if I can track that down for us.
Okay. To the person who asked that question, just feel free to email me and I'll forward it to Christy and she can try and get you that list. We have time for one more question before we wrap up here. If a customer creates a debt in a state that you have a license and then they move to another state, would you need to obtain a license in the state they are now living in in order to collect on that debt?
Maybe. it depends on...
Spoken like a true lawyer.
Right. It depends on the scope of that particular state's law, right? Some of them say if you're collecting from a resident in my state, you need it. Other times there are exceptions if the debt was created outside of state. The conservative view is that if a state has a licensing requirement, you should assume, absent, you know, finding some express exception, that the laws of the state of the residence of that debtor are going to apply. But there are exceptions, but the safer course is to assume assume that the law of the state of residence is going to govern.
Excellent. Well, I'm gonna fold in this last question here as well as my final question that I usually ask of my panelists, and that's to offer any sort of summary, words of wisdom, parting advice, takeaways, any other sort of last, you know, bits of information that you want to share, or you know, make sure to reinforce to the audience before we wrap up for today. And if you don't mind, John, I'll let you go first.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak here today. And thank you, Christy. This was great. I think that the comments that were on the slide were the critical ones. You've got to take this seriously. You've got to consult with others who can help you. You have to, and it's so critical because a foot fault, an enforcement action can have a domino effect. And if you're not paying attention and taking this stuff seriously, there can really be significant repercussions.
Absolutely, John. And thank you for joining us today. You have been invaluable on this call. Mine is simple. Talk to the expert. Talk to an attorney. Take it serious, like John said. It's imperative that you review your licensing and you review it often to make sure you're not shut down and gone out of business at some point because you didn't have a license in a state and now you're paying a huge fine.
Excellent. Well, for those of you that are watching the PowerPoint, both the contact info for John and Christy is up on the screen in front of you, or you can absolutely feel free to email me. I'll be happy to forward any questions to them that are sent my way. Before I let everyone go, I want to thank John and Christy for their insights and their time today. No one would have wanted to listen to a webinar with just me talking about state licensing. That would not have been good for anybody. So thanks to both of them for taking their time. Also want to thank Cornerstone Support for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.cornerstonesupport.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and everybody who asked questions. A recording of this event will be posted to the webinar recordings page on accountsrecovery.net in the next few days. And please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Thanks again, everybody, and be sure to enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.